Hi, I'm Doug Johnston. I'm going to read a little bit about from Hit and Run, which is my fourth novel. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to work out what this is about. It's called Hit and Run. It starts with a hit and run in chapter one. So I'm just going to read a little tiny excerpt where there's three people in a car, they're drunk, they're high on drugs, and they've hit a guy. They've got out, and they think the guy's dead. They're standing over the body, like you do. A faint noise made them turn. Down the hill in the distance, two headlights were reaching out along Queen's Drive. The growl of a diesel engine, a taxi, still a long way away. There was a chance it might turn right at the roundabout, head past the standard offices instead of up the hill. Christ, Charlie said. He turned to the other two. Zoe, kill the lights. Billy, come here. They both stood still, staring at the headlights in the distance. Do it, he shouted, making them jump. Zoe ran to the car as Charlie pulled his brother, staggering towards the body. Get his legs. Billy held the man's ankles. Expensive leather shoes, scuffed now. He felt Charlie lift the man's arms. Charlie pointed at the small clump of trees to the side of the road. That way. Billy shuffled backwards with the ankles in his grip, almost dropping them. The man's body scraped on the tarmac between them. They were plunged into near darkness as Zoe reached the car and switched the lights off. She removed the key and slammed the door, then headed over to them. Charlie and Billy looked the other way. The taxi went straight on at the roundabout, heading up the hill towards them, still some distance, headlights pointing away thanks to the bend in the road. They struggled to the pavement with the body, the headlights creeping round the opposite embankment towards them. Zoe took an ankle from Billy as they lugged the body. They reached the edge of the slope and heaved the corpse down into the trees and thick foliage. The taxi was almost on them now, trudging up the hill. Charlie and Zoe grabbed Billy and shoved him down the embankment, diving after him. Billy landed in thick nettles, stinging his hands, his face only a few inches from the dead man. Charlie landed next to him with a thump, Zoe rolling on top of Charlie in the mayhem. They heard the taxi engine ease off as the driver spotted the parked car and slowed. Then the revs picked up as he sped past the Micra and disappeared up the hill. The fading engine rumble left a vacuum behind. All Billy could hear was his own heavy breathing and a thin rustling of leaves. Zoe extricated herself from Charlie, then the two of them got up. Billy didn't look at the dead body, only a few inches away to his right. Instead, he gazed up at the sky, packed full of stars. Zoe and Charlie offered him their hands and he let himself be lifted. Every movement meant more nettle stings, but Billy somehow enjoyed the sharp jabs of pain. He scrambled up the bank, Zoe and Charlie ahead of him. Billy looked along the road, darkness in both directions. Come on, Charlie said. He pushed Billy into the back seat of the Micra and then took the keys from Zoe. I'll drive. He got in the driving seat, Zoe in the front passenger, Billy alone in the back. Charlie started the engine and switched the lights on, then pulled out sharply, forcing Billy into his seat. As they drove away, he stared out the window at the starry sky, his mind numb.
So, Doug, do you consider yourself a crime writer?
Well, good question. I'm on Faber's crime and thriller list. It's interesting, whenever you get asked, I get asked that question a lot. I've never really considered myself a crime writer, although it's a weird kind of definition. If you say crime writing to people, they immediately think of like police procedurals and stuff, which is not what I write at all. I do write kind of thrillers, but then if you say thriller, people think of, you know, big airport thriller novels with like embossed authors' names on the cover, and I don't write them either. So I don't see anything wrong with being classified as a crime writer. I don't have a problem with that. It's just people might have the wrong perception about what the kind of thing that I write. I tend to write contemporary novels which inevitably have crime in them, but then almost all, I mean, one of the core things about good novel writing is to have conflict at the heart of it, and that almost always involves a crime of some kind eventually. But I'm more interested in the sort of thriller element to what I write. There are some great writers of police procedurals. I'm not very interested in who done it. I'm more interested in why they do it and what happens after they've done it, if you know what I mean. In that sort of noir tradition more than anything else. And that's just my own preference. And I'm probably not good enough at plotting to do a proper whodunit, because you have to have a real sense of what to reveal when to the reader. And I don't know, I kind of feel that I just sort of bludgeon on through and drag the reader with me.
So how would you define that thriller element that you say? You said that your books have this thriller element. What is the thriller element?
Well, it's just, I'm interested in, I think this book is kind of, this is my fourth novel, it's been a distillation of this throughout the novels that I've written. I'm interested in what happens if you put regular everyday people like me or you or anyone else into extraordinary circumstances and see how they cope. So in this one, obviously, it's hit and run. So it's three young professionals who make a mistake in chapter one. You don't have to be a brain surgeon to work out what that mistake is, and they pay for it. And I'm interested in how they deal with that, what they do in the aftermath of a split second wrong decision, and how that can impact on their lives and everyone else's lives. And that, in a sense, always has a thriller element to it, because that thing about writing a thriller is about that sort of page turning quality, that something that's dragging the reader on. They have to find out what happens next. And in this case, I mean, you know right at the start what the crime is. That's not the interesting part. The interesting part is how Billy, who's driving, deals with what he's done. And you kind of know, I think you know reading it, that, you can't possibly get away with this forever. And it's, I kind of think hopefully what drags the reader on is them wondering how it's going to fall apart for him, in which specific kind of way, I think.
You mentioned noir. You said that it's a noir novel. One of the definitions I've heard of noir is that you're in trouble in the beginning and it gets worse. What's your definition of noir?
My definition is the one that my agent is a guy called Alan Guthrie, who's also a brilliant crime writer, a noir writer. And he explained it to me very simply when I was kind of early on in my writing career, that noir is about the people doing the crime. It's not about the person solving the crime. And that's about as simple as it gets. It's about people doing bad things. Well, they're not necessarily bad people. In fact, it works better if they're not bad people. If they're just bad people doing bad things, there's nothing really, you're struggling for empathy with the main character or whatever when you're reading it. I think it's trying to get everyday people who would make a decision or who would do something that you could see yourself doing, if you were having a really bad day. And I think that's it. It's to do with the criminals rather than the solving of crimes. But it is also, it's about just ramping up the badness. It's like a noir novel is just the worst day the reader could possibly ever have, times 100, hopefully.
So how do you maintain the suspense in the book like this?
Good question. I don't know. It's fairly instinctive, and I don't. Like I said earlier, I'm not the most professional plotters. I don't sit down and have huge big flow charts and all that sort of stuff. I do have a start planned and an end, and I kind of have a little grey area in the middle where I want to get from one to the other. But it's just a matter of thinking. As you go along, I think something that writers can easily forget is, at the end of this chapter, what would make the reader want to turn over the page and find out what's in the next chapter? I mean, I'm sure it was Chandler, I might be misquoting or misrepresenting him, but wasn't it him that said, if you find yourself in a corner, just have somebody turn up with a gun at the door, and then you've got something else to worry about, I don't quite do that, although I did do that on my last book. But I like that idea that it's just, what could make this worse? What could make this worse? What could make this worse? It's a fun read.
I mean, you mentioned that there, but you do give your protagonist a very hard ride in this book. Was it fun being so tough on him?
Yeah, it's great. It really is, because he's kind of deep down, he's an okay guy. That's what I was hoping for anyway. But he's because of all sorts of things, I don't want to give too much away in the book, but he's clearly suffering from some sort of post-traumatic stress, after the accident, and not just mentally, suffering from various physical things. And also, huge amounts of guilt at what he's done. And he makes some incredibly bad decisions, when he goes to speak to the widow of the guy that he's killed. Because I should probably explain that he's a trainee crime reporter and he has to report on the hit and run that he's committed the next morning. And he gets more involved with, because of that, it's kind of in his face all the time. And that was just great. I love that. The central premise of that is a really neat one for just, ramping things up all the time. Because, it's incredible pressure anyway, having done something like that. And he's incredibly stressed. And then he has to report it. But then he kind of almost sees a way out of it because he knows more about the story than he ever lets on. So he kind of uses that to his advantage to get headline scoops and stuff like that. But then it obviously always comes and backfires. Yeah, it's great fun. There's another thing about noir writing that someone said to me once was it's not enough to to have your protagonist stuck up a tree. You have to throw rocks at them while they try and climb down. I like that.
One of the things that the panel particularly liked about your book was the fact that the character keeps going. I mean, you say he's an ordinary person in an extraordinary situation, but I think most people would stop and have a lie down rather than carry on as your character does. I mean, how did you come up with a character who's resilient enough to have all this thrown at him?
Well, I just think it's a part of it's one of the symptoms of his condition, if you like, the post-traumatic stress, is that he doesn't see a way out, and he has to keep sort of like picking away at the scab of what he's done. And I think it helps that he's young. I mean, he's in his early 20s, and you have a certain amount of resilience, physical, you know, for drinking drugs and stuff like that, that perhaps people of a slightly more mature vintage like us might not. and I think, you know, you can just try and ramp that up. One of these things you don't really realise when you're writing novels, that you do this, you have certain tropes that you have, you know, within all your fiction. And my second novel was about, called The Ossians, was about an indie band, unsigned band, touring the Highlands and falling apart in a mess of drinking drugs. And that guy in that didn't sleep for a whole week at all, I don't think. And Smokeheads, my next novel, was about some guys basically drinking themselves stupid on a on a distillery tour. So yeah, I've got previous for that. I don't know. I didn't say anything about my psyche at all, honest.
Well, it's not just the drinking drugs, though, is it? It's the physical harm that happens to him. I mean, the sort of terrible things. I mean, he's a bit like a sort of Roadrunner and Wile E. Coyote, isn't he? I mean, sort of terrible things happen to him, and he keeps going.
Yeah, I mean, without wanting to give too much away, he does end up in hospital at some point and then checks himself out while no one's looking. But there's a reason for that. I mean, it doesn't, hopefully it doesn't say, I mean, yeah, it is a bit sort of Roadrunner and Wile E. Coyote, but hopefully it's not too cartoonish. It's not out with the realms of possibility that he, you know, because he's obviously in a disturbed mental state. He's in a lot of trouble. He's got a lot of mixed up emotions for various other characters that he thinks he has to save or whatever.
Yeah.
So, despite having had brain surgery, he checks himself out 24 hours later. And that's great, because that increases the dramatic tension, because you know he shouldn't be out and about. He's walking about with a bandaged head, for Christ's sake. But it's just a matter of, you know, this can't go on forever. This is going to end badly. It's just a matter of how badly it's going to end, I think.
So how do you research a book like this?
I just drive around hitting people and driving off without telling anyone. And yeah, that's it.
Well, you mentioned...
No, I'm only joking. I honestly didn't kill anyone in research for this book. It's interesting. I set it all... It's set in Edinburgh. It's deliberately kind of claustrophobic. I hope it's not the sort of tourist area of Edinburgh necessarily. All the action happens within about 1 or 2 square miles, and it's an area I know really well because I was a student. I still live in Edinburgh now, but I was a student and lived in that area. Driven around that part of the town, walked around it, drunk in those pubs, you know. And I also worked for a brief time at the Scottish Standard offices, which is actually the Scotsman offices. You know where they are. And it just, so that research was very easy because, I knew it all. I knew that really well. As for the other stuff, you know, it just, use your imagination. I'm with Ian Banks when he says that he became a novelist, so he had to do the least amount of research possible. Because if you write a non-fiction book, then you have to do proper research, because people can call you up on it.
I went to see you read the other evening, and you mentioned on stage that not only did the book grow out of an interest in car crashes, but you also sang a song about a car crash. So when did this start, this obsession with car crashes?
And we get on the psychiatrist's chair. I don't know. It started a few years ago. I became quite obsessed with writing about car crashes in various different forms. I did crash a car once, a long time ago, over 20 years ago, and it was a red Nissan Micra, as features in Hit and Run. But I don't know why that would bubble to the surface of my psyche now. No real reason. And nobody was hurt in that crash, I hasten to add, except my mum and dad, whose car it was. They didn't appreciate that. It was more, they were crushed by the whole thing. Anyway, I was weird. I don't really know where these things come from. And it's best not to poke too deeply at that. I just use it. I mean, I have written, my previous novel, Smokeheads, had, it turned on a car accident. And yeah, I'd written 3 songs, come also in a band. I've written 3 songs about car crashes and a couple of short film scripts and a couple of short stories. I don't know. It's one of the things about car crashes is that they're, you know, they're obviously inherently dramatic. It's useful in that sense. just for ramping up the excitement of someone's going to, you know, be reading and think. And it's a kind of one weird thing about, I said this once at an event, I was saying, you know how you're driving along and you think, if I just went like that into oncoming traffic, and everyone sort of looked at me aghast, obviously, and I was like, okay, that's just me then. But it's something like, I mean, almost everyone drives, you know, the vast majority of people drive, or we're speeding around the country in these massive, 1.5 tons of metal, we could all die at any minute. It strikes me as bizarre that we all take it in our stride like the way we do.
I mean, obviously, J.G. Ballard was famous for his interesting car crashes. Was he an influence on this?
Well, I love that book. I mean, I'd love Ballard, and that's a fascinating book. I actually thought it was David Cronenberg's film. I thought that was terrible. I thought it was an awful film version of it. I didn't think he got it at all. But I read Crash quite a long time ago now, I was probably quite impressionable. And I was just like, wow, this is so messed up. Like, just the central premise of that book is so weird and subversive and sort of transgressive. It's a really strange idea, but I was kind of drawn to that because it was kind of a symptom of that thing we're all, that 21st century malaise, even though it was written before, the 21st century, we're all kind of going about the world disconnected from each other. And the idea that you could get erotically charged by crashing your car. Wow, I wish I'd come up with that idea.
You mentioned there a couple of times, you mentioned your interest in music as well as writing. So which is more important to you, writing or playing in a band?
Well, I couldn't imagine myself not doing either of them. The focus of my kind of life at the moment is writing, definitely. The music I've done for a lot longer. I've been in and out of bands for years. Easily 20 years, and I love kind of the last band I was in. I'm doing some solo stuff now. It's become more of a hobby, but it's not a hobby we would ever give up, and it's certainly something. It's certainly something we take seriously when we do it. But I'm kind of more. I find it. Well, there's more chance of making a living out of writing than making music. I found that anyway, and I think it's more and more these days that you have to be. I don't want to say a jack of all trades, a master of none, but I don't see any problem with, spreading yourself widely and doing as many things as possible. I mean, I'm also, I do a lot of arts journalism, which I've done since before I was writing novels, actually. And I'm just sort of dipping my toes in the water of TV and film writing and things like that. And I think it keeps it interesting if you get a chance to do one. The writing of music is a lot more instinctive, I think, than my writing of fiction. There's no planning involved. You just sort of pick up a guitar and wait for the muse to strike, as it were. You make it sound very pretentious when you say it like that. But so they're kind of very different disciplines, I think, which maybe that's one of the reasons I like to do them both, is that one is a kind of a little bit of a release valve from the other one, I think, maybe.
And what about reviewing books? I mean, that's something you do as well. Where does that fit into the whole thing?
It's just a handy little pays the bills. Well, that's not strictly true. I did that. I was a book reviewer before I was writing novels. I love that in one sense because it keeps you absolutely up to date with what people are writing, what's happening in the literary world, and you come across some amazing, new writers all the time, which is really refreshing. Unfortunately, it means that I review because I'm a freelancer. I write for a number of different publications, and I just started counting up, and I review like about 8 or 9 books a month at the moment, which is it's around about 2 a week, and it doesn't really give me a chance to read anything else.
Sure, sure.
So if I don't get commissioned to review something, I don't get to read it. So yeah. My to read pile is astronomically high to the point that it's going to teeter over and kill someone in the house.
The book has a very cinematic feel. Are films an influence on you?
Yeah, I think that's inevitable with people of kind of my generation. I am as much influenced by film as I am by literature, I think. And it strikes me that that's a no-brainer because it's just that's how I was brought up, I think. I certainly wasn't brought up in an ignorant household where we didn't have books. I was doing lots of reading. But, you're exposed to film and TV and all the tropes of those things. From an incredibly early age, even a sort of child of the 70s like me, it must be 100-fold now. Sure. I've got 2 young kids and, they're exposed to that stuff, all the time. Less so when I was, grew up in the 70s, but still a lot of it. And I think Yeah, you do. I mean, I don't ever sit down and think this will have to be cinematic.
True.
That's not how the brain works. But I think it's inevitable that that bleeds into it. You automatically think in terms of films or television that you've liked that have influenced you. You know, even little moments in films. There's a kind of obvious homage slightly to things like Deliverance and stuff like that in the stuff I write. Because I love that idea of the sort of split second decision of what you're in a situation, and you know you have to decide there and then, you know, what you're going to do, and then the rest of the story unravels from that, you know, split second decision. And I love that kind of thing. And I think you know, film, certainly cinema, is absolutely the most, for me, it's the most direct art form, I think. You know, you can do incredible things in 90 minutes, you know, on a big screen. I mean, obviously, like, literature has its own advantages for getting inside character and mindset and stuff. But, you know, you can make people... I mean, I've cried more at films than I've ever cried, you know, reading books.
Sure.
And that strikes me as... I mean, I'm trying to do that in my writing. I'm trying to make it as visceral as possible. I'm trying to make it as emotionally engaging, for better or worse, as possible. You know, so with that in mind, you know, why wouldn't you be influenced by film, I think?
It's a very fast-paced read. Was it fast to write as well? Does that reflect the writing process?
Yeah, it was fast, which kind of made me worry at the time that it was rubbish, because I'd struggled a little bit with earlier novels, and not struggled, but they'd taken longer.
Sure.
And they'd taken, I mean, I'm not one to labour over, you know, a sentence for a day. That's not how I work. It's maybe the journalism sort of experience that I just, you know, I get my head down for a few hours, bash stuff out in short bursts as well, because I tend to find that if I'm writing for longer than a couple of hours, that the energy tends to flag in the prose. So I kind of just stop at that point and then, you know, come back to it the next day or later on that day or whatever and get a new burst of energy into it. But yeah, I mean, it's very deliberate, and it seems to be, the books have been getting faster paced as I've been, you know, as I've been going along, and I've been writing them faster. I mean, this one, the first draft was less than 3 months, and it felt right, which again, being the sort of paranoid Scotsman that I am, I thought, oh, this is too easy, this must be rubbish. but you know, then you get the redrafting
sure.
and all that sort of stuff. And when I showed it to a couple of people that I, you know, writers that I respect their opinion, they were like, this is really good. So I was like, you know, well, I was reasonably happy that it wasn't a total mess at that point. But yeah, I think, yeah, I'm not one. I mean, I don't write long books, I don't write long, sprawling family saga epics or anything like that. So it's easier for me in a sense. But I can bash out a first draft in 3 months now, I'm pretty sure. Sounds like a real, banging away in the type. I can bash out a first draft in a couple of months, easy.
Your next one will now take you 5 years.
Yeah, probably. I've cursed it now.
And how do you feel about being selected for Fiction Uncovered?
Oh, it's brilliant. Fiction Uncovered. No, I mean, it's really, I think it's really interesting. Yeah, you know, absolutely chuffed, totally thrilled. And it's a really interesting spread of books. I mean, as a, inverted commas, a crime writer, going back to your first question. Yeah, it's interesting to be included. I mean, there's some really, really great books in there, some really interesting stuff, and it's really diverse. And it kind of just shows, I think, the kind of spread of... great writing that's out there, you know, across genres and whatever, however else you want to define them. There's just like loads of great writing. And one of the interesting things about this list is that it's, almost everything on it is the kind of book that I would want to read, because these are the kind of writers that I like. That I'm not massively into big mainstream writers. And I'm not, if I'm honest, you know, a huge fan of the more esoteric literary end of the scale. But none of these books seem to be like that. They seem to be kind of, you know, approachable yet cleverly crafted, which is, you know, bingo, good stuff.